Hello, superstars, and welcome back to another episode of Word Up with Danny Katz. Today, I am joined by me. Yes, I'm solo podcasting today, and we're doing it differently today because I'm back to writing, which feels fantastic, and I'm working on an article, and so a lot of what I get inspired to get off my chest, move through me and out into the realm through this podcast is now going onto the page, which, truth be told, is my preference. So there's not a lot that I'm feeling inspired to like go all over the place about. And of course, I have plenty of things to say and share. So we're gonna do a little bit of a propaganda lesson in the beginning, and then I'm going to read you an essay from a book that has not yet been published in this timeline or reality construct. Before I dive into all of these things, I am reminding you to click that subscribe button, to like, to share, to comment, to leave me a review on any or all of the podcast platforms, to navigate on over to dannykatz.com and sign up for my newsletter so you can stay abreast of the latest, greatest offerings. Live stuff, new books, you know, the stuff. It will be the first place to get all the details and the registration link for my upcoming free, yet to be named, pop propaganda webinar. I'm gonna do a 45-minute gift to you and yours. I'm not even gonna go into pitching it at this point. All I'm letting you know is save the date, August 21st, 2025. That is a Thursday night, 6 p.m. Mountain Time, and details forthcoming. And when you sign up for my newsletter, you will be the first to get all the details for that free offering, which will likely fill up quickly. So it is a good idea to get on the mailing list to make sure that you can get in. All right, that does it for housekeeping. Let's dive into the meat of the matter. So, before we dive into the essay and the reason why I'm choosing to read you guys an essay, I want to dive into the latest bit of propaganda that I've unearthed on ChatGPT. And I don't know why any of us, including myself, are surprised that it is propagandizing the public in the exact same way that internet searches are, that Wikipedia is, that newspapers, that online news, that all of it is lying. It's exactly the same. And because I get requests, I get inquiries about my pop propaganda program. Does it include ChatGPT? Does it include OpenAI, these large languaging models? Are OpenAI and ChatGPT the same thing? Maybe. I really don't care because I'm so excited for all of it to go away, even though I recognize its utility as a marketing consultant for me, for sure. And they're using the same tactics. Like, it doesn't, I'm happy to go into the details as to how this large languaging model is doing it, like the subtle nuances of that, especially because it doesn't have images to use the way so many of the other propaganda delivery paradigms, media are doing it, have it. Whatever the end of that sentence was, I am feeling a little bit cancel clearly. I'm calling in more grounding today. I have been staving off a physiological upgrade by way of moving an imbalance out of my chest throat area. And it's just, you know what it's like when we're transmuting an imbalance or detoxing in ways that are described as like flu or a cold or bioweapon attack, whatever. But for me, it's like I'm partly here, but I'm partly in this other dimension because there's like the sensations and the kind of distraction or redistributing of my attention on that. But then when it's a bioweapon, then there's like the alien frequencies and everything attached to those. And it's like processing and transmuting. Anyway, I am calling in grounding and clarity. So I mentioned that I am working on an article, and so I'm delving deeper into all the Michigas controversy around the Soldiers Monument here in Santa Fe and everything that it portends and stands for and all of the money and interests and agendas behind it. Because of course, it's not like a standalone, authentic, not at all contrived protest by the people. It's not what that is or was on any level. So I have been using ChatGPT to help me with my research. And as we're all learning, like, it gets things wrong and it deliberately lies and it deliberately propagandizes. So I took screenshots so as not to bore us with the scroll through. And here we go. Okay. So I'd asked the ChatGPT how many people were at the protest, because remember, this was October 2020. We were in hard lockdown, right? We were prohibited from, by emergency mandates, emergency proclamations, to not go to funerals, to not visit our loved ones in elderly homes or the hospital, to issue gathering at all for any level. I know personally, I was in a park with some people, and a kind citizen who thought tattletaling was super fun called the cops on us, and we had the cops come, and they actually didn't tell us to disperse, but they were supposed to tell us to disperse. Anyway, it was during this time where public gathering was totally prohibited. To go out in public, we had to muzzle ourselves and stand 6 feet apart, unless we were protesting some sort of like colonialism, racism, land back, identity, something, right? Then COVID didn't affect us, right? There was no public health danger at all as long as we were protesting some sort of leftist ideological something, right? So that's when this happened. And I was just curious to know how many people were gathering when the rest of us were social distancing. Here's what it said. On Indigenous Peoples Day, October 12th, 2020, approximately 50 protesters gathered in Santa Fe's plaza to demand the removal of the controversial Soldiers Monument, AKA the obelisk. This monument, erected in 1868, commemorated Union soldiers who fought against Indigenous peoples in the 19th century, with a plaque that once referred to them as savage Indians, a term that has been chiseled off, that had been chiseled off in 1974. Okay, so I want us to just note, because this part is true, the monument was erected in 1868. That is a very valuable historical relic marking the actual history of this land, of Santa Fe, of this part of New Mexico, of our entire country, because let's not forget that Santa Fe is the oldest capital city in this country. So this is a very valuable historical monument for us to hopefully cherish and safeguard. Our mayor, he who was allegedly elected to safeguard and steer the well-being of Santa Fe, he facilitated this, not just removal, but violent destruction of a statue that went up in 1868. So what I want to point our attention to is the part where it says, this monument commemorated Union soldiers who fought against Indigenous peoples in the 19th century. Okay, so this is what, I just asked an honest question. I didn't even ask what the protest was about. I asked how many people were at the protest, and then ChatGPT, sentence number two, is telling me why this happened. It does this, right? It gives way too much information. It's like an average student who has been assigned an 800-word essay and is too half-assed to really put any like real thought or intention into it. So just throws out words and sentences saying nothing to like take up space. That's what ChatGPT does. And it's a lie. That's not why the monument was erected, but I asked it a straightforward question, and this is the very first thing it gives me. So this is comparable to when we're doing internet searches, more so Google than DuckDuckGo, but I certainly don't have much faith in DuckDuckGo anymore, that the first bit of information they give you, what they elevate the highest, is a lie, is propaganda. So then I pressed it on this piece of information, and I wrote, "That's false, though. The Soldier's Monument does not commemorate soldiers' defeat of the indigenous peoples. It celebrates the defeat of the Confederate soldiers. Why would you propose otherwise?" I'm always asking the ChatGPT, like, who programmed you to do this? Like, what is your propaganda angle? And it always denies it. So here's its response. "Thanks for pointing that out. You're absolutely right to clarify this. The Soldiers' Monument in Santa Fe, erected in 1868, primarily commemorates Union soldiers, primarily commemorates Union soldiers who fought during the Civil War, specifically those who defeated the Confederate forces. The monument has been a subject of controversy, not because it celebrates a victory over indigenous peoples per se, but because of the language historically associated with it, such as the plaque that once referred to savage Indians, which was removed in 1974, and its symbolism within the context of colonialism and indigenous erasure." So I'm not going to get into the whole savage Indians piece. I'm just not inspired to talk about that today, maybe some other time. And so one of four plaques, apparently I'm getting into it. That's amazing. Mercury is so retrograde, is it not? Okay, so as I understand it, there were four plaques, each commemorating different. No, you know what? I don't want to go into it. I'm not going to go into it. What I will say, just shorthand it, is that when it was built, one of four plaques that were affixed as part of the monument's base mentioned a defeat of the savages. Now, at the time, 1868, that term held a very different meaning than our 2020 whatever interpretation of it. It's not to excuse it at all. I'm just saying this has been what has become conflated with exactly what ChatGPT just told us, the defeat of the indigenous people, and then the way that the radical activists have ran with that, the genocide. It's a genocide, which is insane. So he goes on to say, I did it. Like, please don't be like me, clear, cancel, delete. Let's not ever personalize or genderize these large languaging models. "The protests in 2020 were focused on those broader issues. The monument is a symbol tied to settler colonial narratives and the marginalization of indigenous peoples, rather than a direct commemoration of indigenous defeat." That's not really true, though, because, well, it is true that they focus on broader issues, but then they, like, I'm just going to give them the benefit of a doubt. They got confused or mistakenly conflated like these larger ideas of genocide with there were battles fought in this land, which isn't a genocide. Does not a genocide make like a battle wherein both sides are fighting to win? Anyway, "The protests in 2020 were focused on those broader issues. The monument as a symbol tied to settler colonial narratives and the marginalization of indigenous peoples, rather than a direct commemoration of indigenous defeat." So then it goes on to say, "The protests in 2020 were focused on those broader issues. The monument as a symbol tied to settler colonial narratives and the marginalization of indigenous people, rather than a direct commemoration of indigenous defeat. The Indigenous People's Day protests aimed to call attention to these complexities and demand changes in how history is represented publicly." I mean, that is a generous translation of what happened. And I'm not even going to go into to take the other side, but just if we're just sticking with the languaging that's functioning as propaganda here, the protests in 2020 were focused on these broader issues rather a direct commemoration of Indigenous defeat. That's not true because their narrative was propped up by the narrative that they created, that statue was commemorating an Indian genocide, an Indian defeat, which is exactly what ChatGPT is parroting. It's not using the word genocide, but like, no, there is the rewriting of that history that's propping up this like larger demand to like completely erase Hispanic culture in Santa Fe. So it was an important piece of the puzzle, but I love how ChatGPT, which is just supposed to what sift through the information and regurgitate it back, but it consistently gives this leftist slant in telling us how to think about it because it's interpreting it. This is what I'm saying. When we're deciphering fact from fiction on these large language models, notice when it tells you how to interpret neutral reality, or where it claims to have the authority of what the intentions are. So we're looking at focus, aimed, intend, meant, right? These words are the large languaging models telling us how to think, indoctrinating us with the angles and opinions and judgments that it like subtly infuses on what really is supposed to be, if we were, you know, if there was any semblance of like ethics or neutrality to this whole AI nonsense, then it would be beholden to neutrality. But anyway, the last piece. So the monument's original intent was to honor Union soldiers and their role in the Civil War. But the protests also engage with the monuments later. So it had to throw it. And this is another thing that you'll always see it do is like it will concede the point that I'm pushing it on, right? And try this yourself and see if you have the same thing. But I would say 100% of the time, let's go 99. Let's just give it a little room for an exception. When I push back on what I know is blatant propaganda or blatant persuasion or a blatant lie or mistake, it'll give me some long thing. And at the very end, it will concede the point that I'm making. And then it will finish it up with like its excuse for whatever like ideological bent or political bent that it's been like programmed to subtly push. What it's doing, it's very simple, is like it's the last idea that goes into our head we're the most likely to hold on to. So also just notice like what it chooses to tack on the backside of whatever your real question is. Be mindful that this thing is programmed to propagandize us in the same way that everything else coming through the screens is programmed to propagandize us. And so remember, save the date. Thursday, August 21st, 6 p.m. Mountain Time, I'm going to be doing a 45-minute propaganda something to help us attune and safeguard ourselves from this kind of nonsense. Okay, so that's it for our propaganda lesson. Now, into the main part of the show, today's essay. Those are nice colors together. I like that. For those listening with your ears, I'm commenting on the color of my extra hydrating water and then the color of the scarf on my head, which I'm wearing as I continue to train myself to not mess with the hair situation. I think it's going pretty well. I'm also inviting scarf sponsorships, all headgear sponsorships, Tiara. I'm really inviting Tiara, Crown, beautiful headband, whatever, sponsorships for the show. And I've just decided, like, this just happened this morning. How fun can I make everything? How much more fun and ease and relaxation can I add into everything? So, removing importance has been a total game changer. And I won't go into the others. As far as fun goes, I'm thinking, how fun to have like a fashion segment for my podcast and be sponsored by different like awesome fashion houses. like 45 RPM in Japan, which would be my A number one choice. But I would go for like, who else is awesome? A Black Crane, a Rundholz, Vince. Keep it simple. I'll go for Vince. I'm happy to be sponsored by Vince for the show. So putting it out there, this is like this nice kind of thick. It's like a burlap linen, which I love. It's not scratchy, although I don't mind me a scratchy fabric, which I've heard is an Aquarian thing because we tend towards the eclectic. That's not what I was trying to say. We tend towards the electric. And I also like me a good scratchy wool. This, though, I love like an easy, just easy summer. Kind of medium weight, burlappy linen, and yeah, I'm super comfy cozy, and I'm excited for this schmata on my body being a 45 RPM cashmere. How fun is that gonna be? Okay, so why essay? Here is why, my lovelies. I was fortunate enough to interview Steven Jenkinson this week. And if you haven't checked out my first interview with Steven Jenkinson, please go find it on the Odyssey or the Locals or even the Patreon and delight in my delighting with such a delightful man. I am such a fan of his word wizardry, his wisdom. I mean, it's just like next level. Anyway, I was going to put that out this week, and then I realized that his new book, Matrimony, is coming out August 12th. So I figured it would be smarter and more aligned to time the launch of the podcast when the book was ready, because everyone, as soon as they hear Stephen, say a word about it, say three like magical, perfectly woven, thoughtful, ever unpackable words together, people are going to want to read it. The other reason why I'm not jonesing to go after culture right now is because I'm giving myself a respite from it. Emily and I made the executive decision to not be holding ourselves to politics. I'm trying to think of yesterday's shows. I'm like, but did we get into them anyway? Anyway, I am delighting in pulling my attention away from the sham show. And yeah, just reading. And speaking of reading, I have been mostly reading and now writing and delightfully reading, reading, reading. So I mentioned Stephen's new book, Matrimony, and I was pouring through it, like gobbling it up, because my intention to finish it in time for our podcast. I got three quarters of the way through, and even that was its own exercise in, I don't know, focus, discipline, because if I had my druthers, I would slowly meander my way through Stephen's every sentence and like delight and unpack and repeat and play with, because each one is like a portal to like, half a dozen ahas, and you get the picture. I dig his writing. Anyway, the book is called Matrimony. And while it absolutely focuses on matrimony, as in the marriage ceremony, as in weddings, as in the standard American wedding, the way that he unpacks it in his like granular and multidimensional way, it is, of course, a larger critique of like dozens and dozens of aspects of our ailing culture. He calls it a culture in crisis. Anyway, the topic at hand was weddings, marriage, that type of bond. And of course, as I was reading the book and speaking with Stephen, I kept coming back to a book that I wrote called Love in the Time of Chemtrails. I opted not to publish that book. Why? Why didn't I publish that book? Well, I'm just going to give you a brief overview of what happened with that book. So I believe it was 2008. I wrote a cover story for the LA Weekly called Lust in LA. And it was about this relationship I had with a married couple and how it all imploded. And then against the backdrop of that was me like exploring and unpacking how kind of broken the mating landscape was for Gen X people in, on the east side of, well, I guess all of Los Angeles, during that time. And just like this larger reflection of those of us born, Pluto in Libra and post-second wave feminism collateral damage, right? Because so many of us can't coming from these homes where people were getting divorced and dads were being excommunicated and made irrelevant, right? All of these things influencing. And then, of course, everything in our culture contributing it from toxicity in media indoctrination, like whatever, what have you. So that was the gist of the article. When I wrote the article, I had this like 15-minute splash, literary splash in LA and various like production companies and publishers coming at me to write the movie, write the television show, write the book. And very long story short, like I just wasn't ready for any of that and it wasn't aligned for me. Anyway, I did end up writing the book when I was in Santa Fe. That's actually what took me to Santa Fe in 2011 was I got a series of writing residencies here to write this book from which I will be reading today. And what I found in the publishing process, because there were some like powerful, like heavy-hitting establishment publishing houses who were really interested in it. And what I was coming up against was working with the editors, or there were some moments where I was working with my own agent who had her own polish requests. But the book that I ultimately wrote was exactly like an unpacking of what I just shared about the article. It was just like this larger kind of cultural critique as to where we were going awry as men and women on the like sexual relation front, forefront, maybe. And what I was coming up against in all these instances are these gatekeepers, these editors, these agents who have these personal blocks around certain ideas and demand from their like personal and not nowhere near objective perspective what needed to come out of my book, like how circumcising our boys was traumatizing them, how single parent households were traumatizing them, how not breastfeeding babies was traumatizing them. And like in all these instances, what I would come up against was like women who weren't breastfeeding or women who circumcised their kids or women who, like whatever it was, and their inability or unwillingness to acknowledge their own personal biases because of the choices that they had made and the like egoic affront that the ideas in my book was proposing, instead of like looking at their stuff, they were just like, no, you have to take that out of your book. And so, ever the don't tell me what to do kind of rebel, that didn't work for me. So then I was like, all right, well, I'll just self-publish it. And then I had this 2.5 year long lesson in boundaries with my then boyfriend editor, and basically like just overwrote, over-edited, and then it just got to the point from working on it for so long, like I can't even look at it. Like, if you ever heard Bjork talk about Vulnicura and like the making of that and the idea of performing that, it was like that version, except obviously my unpublished, slightly mangled essay collection is not a comparable artistic offering as Bjork's Vulnicura. Lest you think I'm making that kind of comparison. So, I thought to share with us in honor of my forthcoming interview with Stephen Jenkinson about his new book, Matrimony, from my book, The Language of, no, it's not called The Language of, it's called Love in the Time of Chemtrails. So here we go. This was the first chapter. I might very well delve into reading more chapters. We'll see how this goes. Actually, this is a perfect experiment. As you are listening or watching, please, please weigh in on the comments your honest take on me reading you guys one of my essays on the podcast, and we will take it from there. In the meantime, here we go. The first essay, Happily Never After. Okay. Sorry I'm late, I gasp, winded from the exertion, having sprinted off the elevator, through jewelry, then skincare, then accessories, up three flights of spiraling marble stairs, in and around Prada and Herrera and Watanabe, and finally into Barney's New York's infamous bridal shop, where my mother and her best friend Marcia are pouring through Vera Wang's spring collection. The caterer was totally unprepared. I had to wait while he garnished the blinis and then scooped this bland, boring tartare into way too greasy wonton skins, and I still left before he even started plating the salads. What really happened is that I was up all night doing mushrooms in Topanga Canyon and woke up way late with nasturtium in my hair and a feverish need to jump in the ocean, and then let my boyfriend talk me into dropping him off at his Beechwood Canyon art studio, at which point I realized I was parched and grabbed a green juice before trekking backwards to Beverly Hills to try on wedding dresses. And you couldn't have picked up a phone? My mother asks, dragging a perfectly manicured finger across the sleeve of an organza eyesore. Or run a comb through your hair? Sorry, I roll my eyes, leaning in to kiss her cheek, where a fresh 2-inch scar is just starting to scab over near the front of her ear. Mom, did you get another facelift? Mm-hmm, she nods, beaming, because elective surgical procedures make her incomprehensibly happy. Why? You don't have any wrinkles. Not anymore, she trills. Don't get me wrong, my mother has plenty of imperfections, but wrinkled skin is not one of them. Her complexion is flawless, eerily untime-marked. At least it was until she started having all this useless surgery that just makes her look shiny and pulled and wrong. Be nice, Marcia whispers, kissing me on the cheek and then pulling back to wipe her signature orange lipstick off my face with her thumb. It's Mother's Day. I know it's Mother's Day. If it wasn't Mother's Day, I wouldn't be in Beverly fucking Hills ad-libbing outlandish details about my make-believe wedding within deliberate earshot of a clearly sedated shop girl who may or may not realize we're full of shit. I know you have no intention of paying for Mother's Day brunch, my mother barked into the receiver before I'd even had a chance to say hello. Regardless of my intentions, which in this instance I hadn't yet honed in on, I never actually pay for Mother's Day anything. It's not because I'm cheap or selfish, though if you ask my mother, I'm both. Rather, it's because she drops zingers like this before I have the chance to cultivate any genuine intentions, let alone reach for my wallet. And then, because it's Mother's Day and I know how much it means to her to be right, I surrender to the narrative she's projecting. And I don't want to have to pretend to like another crappy beaded necklace you make me, she continued. So for Mother's Day, we're going to Barney's to try on wedding dresses, so I can at least see you in one before I die. To be clear, my mother isn't battling cervical cancer, Lou Gehrig's disease, or any other terminal malady. This is simply her way of letting me know how I am, yet again, failing to be a good Jewish daughter, because at 34, I've yet to gift her any of the conventional lifestyle achievements her friends with married, employed kids get to brag about, unless we count the 10-day silent meditation retreat I completed in March, or the Giardia I contracted in Rishikesh and then cured with ass-lodged chunks of basil-wrapped garlic, which, of course, we don't. I agreed because I'm not a total asshole and it is Mother's Day, and because it saves me the time and cash I would ordinarily spend making yet another crappy beaded necklace she will only ultimately ever appreciate as a cat toy. And so here I am, bouncing from foot to foot in mismatched skivvies while rambling about my imaginary fiance and our fake wedding plans, all so that my mom can see me as a bride before she dies, even though she's perfectly healthy despite her addiction to aspartame and cosmetic surgery. The fact that we are at Barney's only underscores the fantasy we are indulging. If I were really getting married, we'd be meeting at Marshall's or Santee Alley because, according to her, only Gentiles pay retail. I've always loved Big Sur, I explained to the shop girl as she fastens the 100+ buttons tracing my spine on the hand-tatted lace column that costs as much as my master's degree and is already choking me. And since Jake proposed at Esalen, it seemed only fitting to do a destination wedding there. Turn around, my mother orders, sipping champagne on a chintz settee in the dressing room. Stand back. I roll my eyes and stomp backwards, arms dangling lifelessly by my sides, forgetting that the newly engaged woman I'm pretending to be thinks wedding dresses are the shit, loves the lace, the glitz, the poof, and the pageantry, and isn't at all self-conscious about going all spastic and squealy over the chance to wear one. No, my mother sneers, dismissing the lingerie-inspired slip dress garnished with 9 billion hours worth of hand-stitched embroidery. You're too short for bias cut. Plus those shoulders, Marcia adds. Gymnastics, nods my mother, referencing the 13 years of Olympic training that rendered me broad-backed and limber, albeit achy when it rains. Try the Empire waist. 7 dresses and umpteen lies later, Marcia is tipsy, my mother is drunk, and I'm over it. These dresses are exhausting me, laden with multiple generations worth of indoctrinated hope and pomp and fantasy. I'm not just trying on a strapless princess gown with a brocade train. I'm donning an antiquated worldview that would have me believe it's possible to staple a lifetime warranty onto love, and that it's somehow reasonable to spend what could feed Haiti for a year on a dress I will wear once. Can we be done now? I sigh, picking a string of seaweed out of my still semi-damp hair. She says nothing. Maybe she didn't hear me. Her hearing is starting to go. Marcia, remind me, is today a holiday? Nope, she heard me just fine. Why, yes, Leslie, it is. And I forget, it must be early onset Alzheimer's. What holiday is it? Why, today is Mother's Day. Oh, right, she exclaims in mock epiphany, turning her Cheshire sarcasm teeth my way. No, we cannot. I don't know that my mother really believes I'll never get married. I think she's just still pissed about Ari. What about Ari? She asked when I impulse bought a ticket to India and called to borrow her universal plug. Oh, yeah. It hadn't occurred to me to consult my boyfriend of 3.5 years before booking a one-way flight to another hemisphere. I was simply following my gut's prompting, which went a little something like this. Go to India next week for as long as you feel like it. Certainly there were things to discuss, the rent, the cats, the moving of my car on street cleaning days. Hey, I greeted him as he walked through the door of our Los Feliz duplex after a long day teaching English to special needs adolescents in Watts. Let's break up. It's not like our relationship was terrible or anything. It was fine, comfortable, predictable, basically everything India wasn't. I was leaving to shake things up, to transform into a bigger, brighter, and infinitely more evolved version of myself. A bigger, brighter, infinitely evolved version of myself that didn't want to be stifled inside an irrelevant relationship dynamic on the flip side of my spiritual odyssey. But I didn't say any of this. Instead, I explained that I had no idea how long I would be gone and didn't think it was fair to expect him to wait for me while I wrote out my Saturn return on the other side of the planet. Because why be honest and take responsibility for my feelings when I could just as easily run a line of codependent bullshit and pretend I was more concerned for its comfort than I was for my own? But I don't want to break up, he pouted and then perked up, struck by an epiphany. I know, let's get married. You're kidding, right? I snorted, rolling my eyes and heading to the bedroom to resume packing. I couldn't get my ass to India fast enough. You're horrible, my mother declared, slowing to a stop in front of the international terminal at LAX. Ari deserves better than you. I hope someday someone dumps you just as thoughtlessly. Ladies and gentlemen, my mother. She's got your same mirror stance, Leslie, Marcia says as I sink into my hip, considering my reflection, right foot turned out 90 degrees, nibbling my thumbnail. No, I don't, I counter, dropping my hand and turning my foot parallel to the other. My mother watches Fox News, drinks Diet Coke, and gets botulism injected into her crow's feet. And I am nothing like her. Nothing! That's the one, my mother declares. It's the last of the dresses. The shop girl excused herself, presumably to drop another Vicodin, entrusting my mother with the task of buttoning me into the strapless charmeuse column with the black velvet border and the big black velvet bow draping my suddenly heart-shaped tush. I'm so pretty, I blurt, mesmerized by the vision that is bridal Barbie me, wanting everyone I've ever met to see me in the stunner of a gown. Who can I get to marry me? Well, we know Felix isn't gonna do it, cracks my mom. My mother tolerates Felix well enough, considering she regards him as a spoiled dilettante man-child who needs to get his shit together and stop filling my head with metaphysical nonsense. By and large, she doesn't hassle me about our relationship or the 18-year age difference between us. Minus the odd jab at his aimlessness and financial instability. Mexico, she chided into the phone when I told her we were spending New Year's in the Yucatan. Let me guess, you're buying the tickets. No, I'm not, I snapped, neglecting to mention that his parents paid for his flight and I finagled a steeply discounted press rate for our eco lodge, which I was covering. Some girls date older men because they've paid off their mortgages, sowed their lingering oats, and thus make for stable, grounded partners. Other girls date older men because they're emotionally stunted European man boys who skate by on their looks, think ambition is for sellouts, and have plenty of time on their hands to smoke opium on a Tuesday, drive to Big Sur on a dime, and wax stony and circuitous about the shape of the time-space continuum and any number of government/Illuminati conspiracies, including, but not limited to, the deliberate dumbing down of the populace by way of fluoridated municipal water. Yes, but contrails dissipate within a matter of seconds, Felix explained as we lounged butt to butt in our outdoor bathtub. See? I tilted my head back, holding onto my tattered hemp sun hat with one hand while watching the fluffy white streak trailing the commercial jet passing above our heads soften and fade into oblivion. You're right, it's already gone. Exactly, chemtrails don't fade, they just stay there. Poisoning our lungs and our air and our water. God, I love your skin. I giggled as Felix caressed my thigh. Knock, knock, hollered James, tromping through the gate and up the flagstone steps of our garden. It was unnerving at first, the culture shock of living on a commune, how quickly gossip spreads, how often kitchen utensils disappear, how freely neighbors walk in and out of each other's homes, regardless of whether we're dressed, expecting company, or regretting having eaten so many cherries in a single sitting. Oh, sorry, honey, chirped James's waify ginger girlfriend, Zoe, seemingly surprised to see me squatting atop my own toilet. I just need to borrow some floss. Does that really help you poop better? All these years later, I'm almost used to it. Amma's in town, James said, plopping down on a rock next to the tub and removing a cellophane bag of tobacco from the pocket of his vintage suit, which he'd paired with flip-flops and chunky amber beads, but no shirt. Zoe, Beretta, Lifey, and Raven and me are all gonna go. Wanna come? Amma is a South Indian saint who travels the world proffering notoriously healing hugs. She passes through town but once a year, attracting hordes of nasps, with both the free time and the disposition to endure half-day waits for all of 2 seconds in her arms. Now, I'm going to break off from the flow because this is all my books. I love footnotes. I've always loved footnotes. NASP is footnoted here, just so we know what we're talking about. It is short for New Age spiritual people. And fun fact, that phrase was coined by my friend Colin Hudon of Living Tea. He makes a fine, I don't know, well, does he make, yes, he does make a fine tea, and he also sells beautiful teas. So free shout out to Colin over at Living Tea, and thanks for the NASPY. I actually like to pronounce it NASPY. And during this time in LA, we would go to a lot of events or go into Erewhon or whatever and talk about the NASPYs, which we totally were. I hear the wait's like 9 hours, I said, remembering through the haze of the hash brownies we ate for breakfast. Well, that's 9 more hours I get to spend with these adorable appendages, Felix said, nibbling on my big toe. Felix has gone out of his way to structure his life so that he can trip for breakfast, take 4-hour baths, dash off to a pop-up ashram with all of 15 minutes notice, and while away the 9-hour and 43-minute wait, doing essentially nothing, which, let's be honest, is what he does best. To this end, my mom is right. He wouldn't sweep me down the aisle just so I could wear $20,000 worth of silk taffeta for a few hours, nor would he do it as a gesture of love and commitment somewhere down the line, or ever, actually, which is yet another part of the attraction. There's no way in hell he's going to try to shove that tired old narrative down my throat. Marriage is for people who are afraid of freedom, Felix likes to say. Besides, why would anyone voluntarily commit themselves to an institution? We are artists, devoted to our spiritual evolution, and we are way too progressive to dally with such outdated heteronormative institutions as marriage. Besides, I'm pretty sure legally binding relationship contracts shut down the pineal gland. Gong, gong, gong. It's 6 a.m. The Zen Gong alarm clock is chiming. Felix bounds out of bed to put on the kettle while I pad to our outdoor bathroom to pee in a jar, smear some on my face, and down the rest. You drink your pee? Sneered Natasha, a fashion photographer who makes frequent use of Felix's bone structure and physique, and who didn't realize he had a girlfriend until he brought me along to her dinner party, and she pretended she was thrilled to have me. Just morning pee, I explained. It's rife with pineal gland secretions that tonify the third eye. I neglected to mention that drinking it is doing wonders for my complexion because I wanted Natasha to think that I'm above such flimsy trifles as vanity. I think I read something about that in the weekly, she said. It was, Danny wrote that, Felix interjected. Appalling. I dream journal while waiting for the pee on my face to dry, then stare at the rising sun for exactly 19 seconds, flooding my brain with serotonin and divine intelligence. By the time I retrieve my yerba mate from the counter, Felix is already tied into a picturesque lotus pose, deep in the throes of meditation on his deck out back. This is my meditation deck, he announced, surveying the view the hilltop gazebo afforded before we'd unloaded a single piece of furniture from the U-Haul. You can take the one in the front. Why is it yours? I challenged. Because it is. I often brag that I got a gold star in sharing back in Montessori school, still counting it among my more noteworthy achievements. Felix didn't go to Montessori school, having grown up in rural Sweden with conservative parents. But if he did, he would not have earned a gold star or even a silver one. Sharing isn't his strong suit. I just want to be clear, I replied. Do you think that I think that that's a legitimate answer? It is. I let it go. It wasn't worth fighting over. I was happy enough to have my own space to practice. Our devotion to our morning rituals is the glue that keeps us together. Well, that and Felix's frequent trips to Europe. We both need a lot of me time. El Ka Lim Om. Perched atop my meditation cushion on the deck out front, I ring in my practice with four rounds of ascension chanting to honor the elements and rev up my vibrational frequency. El Ka Lim Om. Next, 20 minutes of Tibetan Buddhist death contemplation, which isn't as heavy as it sounds. Really, it's just me silently repeating the phrase, I may die today, I may die today, I may die today, over and over and over again for 20 minutes while observing the thoughts and sensations the mantra triggers. It's not an official Tibetan Buddhist practice per se, but then again, I'm not an official Tibetan Buddhist. Too many rules. Like, Gautama would really give a shit, I mutter when being told for the illionth time not to point my feet at the Buddha statue during the evening lecture at the Mahayana temple we frequent in Silver Lake. It was actually Frogtown, but I'm not in editing mode. I follow up with 20 minutes of meditation, during which I try to observe the thoughts racing through my mind and then berate myself accordingly. I can't believe Felix is going to be in Europe for my art opening and my birthday. I catch myself thinking, he's never here when I need him. Did you really just say the N-word? Asks the detached observer part of myself, witnessing this mid-meditation tantrum. As though one can need without being needy, without being weak and broken and pathetic. But nothing, it continues. Are you hearing yourself? Do you see what a terrible girlfriend you are? Resenting your boyfriend for helping his ailing parents? For not crafting his life around your incessant need for attention? Anyone who thinks meditation is blissful clearly isn't doing it inside my head. My meditations are, well, they're amazing, Felix likes to brag. I just bliss out for hours. It's like ecstasy, only better. You do realize that these crooked thoughts are poisoning your spirit, don't you? The voice continues. Are leaking into the morphogenetic field, are seeping into the ocean and giving baby seals brain cancer. It is a weighty burden orienting oneself to the quantum nature of reality. I follow up my convoluted meditation practice with 8 rounds of alternate nostril breathing to kick my intuition into high gear, a short Sanskrit chant to the yoga gods, and then I start my 2-hour Ashtanga yoga practice. Wash, rinse, repeat daily, except for Saturdays and full and new moons, because while doing away with one's inconvenient humanity is a complex and exhausting task, it is important to take breaks, lest one get rigid or fanatical. 86, 87, 89, 88, 90, 91. We should lead by one, Felix says, kissing my shoulder as he passes me with the garden hose, and I bounce a ball atop a tennis racket with my non-dominant hand, balancing the hemispheres while activating otherwise dormant neural pathways in my brain. Okay, we do have a footnote here. It is an exercise I learned at the Dogon Mystery School I attended in South Central. The Dogon, a West African tribe, are masters of math, science, and stars. The exercise, which includes counting out of traditional order while performing non-dominant eye-hand coordination exercises, jostles the brain into hyper-genius mode, allowing the practitioner to download higher intelligence while tuning up the existing neural functions. See, footnotes are so fun. I love footnotes. That's why if you listen to any of my books on audio, I really recommend buying the print version, if for no other reason than to just check out the footnotes, because I don't read them in the audiobooks. 96, 97, 99, 98, 100. One, I call after him as he waters the lavender bushes alongside his art studio. That's so early. I know, but the ceremony starts at 2, and I promised Jules I'd get her stoned beforehand. She's stuck on bridesmaid duty and none too pleased about it. I was a bridesmaid once, not because I wanted to be or even because the bride wanted me to be, but because we were cousins and our mothers made us. What the hell? Squealed Melissa's mom upon laying eyes on the weird asymmetrical tan marks striping my chest, arms, and chin when I showed up to the bridal suite wearing the requisite Saturn emerald green column with the sweetheart neckline and the sleeves so poofy they dwarfed my head, made even smaller looking by the dyke pixie I was already having enough trouble pulling off. I fell asleep in the sun, I shrugged. I'd spent the previous weekend dropping acid at a Santa Barbara hot spring. By the time I came down, my sneakers were soaking wet and filled with moss. My overalls were draped over a boulder on the other side of the creek, and I was covered in an otherwise nonsensical pattern of crisscrossing tan lines that I am still challenged to make sense of. But you knew about the wedding, Melissa's mom scolded, as though my cousin's over-the-top green card wedding should dictate my preceding social life, as though my role as reluctant bridesmaid should inspire me to curb my love of open water and entheogens so I could stay in tip-top aesthetic form to be part of Melissa's big green harem for her big Jewy wedding to the Russian poet who was missing 2 molars and whom she would divorce less than a year later? That does it for the first half of today's podcast slash happily never after essay reading from the as yet unpublished Love in the Time of Chemtrails. As you are inspired to join me and all these words for the rest of the shebang, which I feel like is pretty juicy read. You can find that over on both my Locals and my Patreon communities, dannycats.locals.com, patreon.com/dannycats. $5 a month gets you access to all my second half content. $10 a month gets you all that plus access to Words with Danny and Emily, my scorched earth deep conspiracy propaganda unraveling podcast. And $20 a month gets you a warm, fuzzy place right here in the middle of my heart. Thanks again for subscribing, hitting the like button, sharing, reviewing on the podcast platforms. If you've read my books and have gotten any value, thank you for reviewing them over on Amazon for me. Those things, it takes like 5 minutes for us to do these reviews. It means the world, the multiverse, to writers like me writing books to, you know, small businesses who, for whom, like, your Yelp reviews are going to be very helpful. So let's be generous and share some reviews. And thank you so much for sharing your sacred attention with me. Thank you for remembering that every word matters, that you are omniscopic amazingness. I will see you over on the Locals and the Patreon. And I'm also reminding you that I will see you on August 21st, 6 p.m. Mountain Time for a soon to be properly announced free pop propaganda webinar. Have a rocking day.